Our first reading today may be familiar to some of you on the congregation's program council. It's a selection I shared there a while back from church consultant Michael Durrell. He begins, "The late William Sloane Coffin said that courage is the first virtue from which all other virtues emanate. Progressive churches seize on this concept," Durrell continues. "They believe that if congregants achieve spiritual maturity, all things become possible. All things. Therein lies the true power of a community of faith." The issue of courage arises in Gilead, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Marilynne Robinson. The stunning novel takes place in the form of a memoir written by a congregational minister to his young son. In the book, the minister writes about his grandfather, also a minister. He writes, "My grandfather had nowhere to spend his courage, no way to feel it in himself. This was a great pity." In congregational life today, Durrell summarizes, "I wonder if we encourage people to spend their courage or to find it in themselves if they feel courage is lacking." Our second reading today is from Dorothy Sauber, a Minnesota farm girl turned Minneapolis professor. Sauber was diagnosed with lung cancer of December 2005. Her book, Cancer Essays, Not the Book I Was Planning to Write, was published posthumously by her sons last year.
"One of my earliest childhood memories is hiccuping as I was looking out the second-story farmhouse bedroom window. My mother, thinking it would be best to scare the hiccups out of me, without warning, pushed me against a window pane and shouted, 'Look, there's a lion in the yard!' I don't remember if the hiccups subsided or not, but I do remember seeing that lion. When I was diagnosed with lung cancer, I was unexpectedly pushed against that window pane again. But this time, rather than seeing a lion out my window, I immediately saw all the ferocious creatures already filling the yards of so many people I've met over the years. This new lion in my yard seems particularly dwarfish compared to wars, refugee camp living, losing young children to curable diseases, and countless other disasters." "But what do you do with your fear?" a friend asked me recently. I didn't have a quick and ready answer, but her question set in motion an examination of what I have or have not learned about my own fears over the years. For starters, I realized that I had been raised by a tribe of fearless people. Every man I knew as a child was a farmer. In hindsight, every one of them must have buried his fear of dangerous machinery and silo asphyxiation deep inside himself before heading out to do his daily farm chores. I witnessed my own father tackle ornery 2-ton bulls and stick his bare hand alongside the hydraulic hitches to pull out entangled hay baler twine. The women I was surrounded by as a child were no different. One winter morning, my mother ran out of the house still in her long flannel nightdress in pursuit of some fast-moving steers headed for the county road. When her bedclothes got caught on the barbed wire fence she was leaping over, she simply pulled herself off of the wire and kept on running, shredding flannel spreading out behind her like steamboat streamers. On our 80-acre farm, fear did not get a say in which jobs got done and which ones were left behind. The night after my diagnosis was my most afraid I've ever been. Suddenly, I feared I'd die too soon. that I wouldn't get everything done that I thought any decent dying person should do before departing. I was afraid I wouldn't wake up the next morning and would lose the last chance to tell everyone I loved just how much they had meant to me all those years. But the wisdom of my tribe quickly kicked in. They knew all too well that if fear rules, the hay will rot and the cows will vanish. I learned from these fearless people that there are daily decisions that we can make to exercise our muscles against being afraid.
Thank you, Nathan. For those of you who were sincerely looking forward to a sermon on the theme warts and all, my apologies. For the rest of you, please know that better judgment does sometimes catch up with me. With Mark up in Detroit with his family after the death of his father, and the fact that I preached on a similar theme just 2 weeks ago, I felt the need to take another tack this morning. In preparation for next Sunday's guest preacher, the Reverend Gail Geisenheimer, this morning I want to talk about what we do as a faith community. I want to talk about courage, and I want to talk about the work of the church, the potentials inherent in our being together, and how we as a group of people, borrowing Marilynne Robinson's phrase, spend our courage, not spend it up, but to put it to work in the world. On April 8th, 2005, San Francisco Chronicle columnist John Carroll coined a new term. It was satirical and perhaps not in the best of taste, but it was funny and for a while, at least in some circles, caught on. Unitarian jihad. Any of you familiar with this? Did Mark and Wendy talk about it? Yeah, all right, we've got some people. So let's go back a little bit. April 2005. We are 2 years into our war in Iraq. Pope John Paul II has just died. Hamas and Islamic Jihad are talking about joining the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And for those of you who are not familiar with this, here is an excerpt from the first communique of Unitarian Jihad. And for those who remember it, this will be a reminder. John Carroll wrote, "Greetings to the imprisoned citizens of the United States. We are Unitarian Jihad. Too long has your attention been waylaid by the bright baubles of extremist thought. Too long have fundamentalist yahoos of all religions, except Buddhism, 14-5 vote, no abstentions, made your head hurt. We are Unitarian Jihad. We are everywhere. We have not been born again, nor have we sworn a blood oath. We do not think God cares what we read, what we eat, and whom we sleep with. Beware. Unless you people shut up and start acting like grown-ups with brains enough to understand the difference between political belief and personal faith, the Unitarian Jihad will begin a series of terrorist-like actions. We will take over television studios, kidnap so-called commentators, and broadcast calm, well-reasoned discussions of the issues of the day. We are Unitarian Jihad. We will appear in public places and require people to shake hands with each other. Sister Hand Grenade of Love suggested that we institute a terror regime of mandatory hugging, but her motion was not formally introduced because of the lack of a quorum. We are Unitarian Jihad, and our motto is, sincerity is not enough. We have heard from enough sincere people to last a lifetime already. Just because you believe it's true doesn't make it true. Just because your motives are pure doesn't mean you are not doing harm. Get a dog or comfort someone in a nursing home or just feed birds in the park. Play basketball. Lighten up. The world is not out to get you, except in the sense that the world is out to get everyone. People of the United States, we are Unitarian Jihad. We can strike without warning. Pockets of reasonableness and harmony will appear as if from nowhere. Nice people will run the government again. I repeat, nice people will run the government again. There will be coffee and cookies in the Gandhi room after the revolution. Jihad, holy struggle. Carroll's piece works as satire because, well, we don't often actually act that way. Oh, we do take the votes and do our best to achieve consensus when we can. But we are not, as I've heard said, the most dangerous religion in America. So often we act as if our sincerity were enough. Well, in the words of my undergraduate philosophy instructor, sincerity is necessary, but never sufficient. In our lives, we do amazing things, but together, as a faith community, movement, if you will, while we've made fabulous contributions to women's rights and the rights of gays and lesbians, the truth is that we have become more often part of the mainstream than on the cutting edge. And so the Unitarian Jihad notion caught on, if only for a little while. It was a great joke, and hey, people were talking about us. There were even websites where you could get your own Unitarian Jihad moniker. Beware, before you stands brother nail gun of reasoned discussion. But all this is play. All this is pretend. It is not real courage. The likes of anyone facing a terminal diagnosis must bring to bear, or that many, farmers included, must manifest each and every day in order to do what they must do. It takes courage to lead a life of integrity, to face even day-to-day challenges, to live a life worth living. What I want for us is to recognize and lift up the ways in which courage is so very much a part of this faith community. And together, I want to grow our capacity for living courageously. A year after publishing his column on Unitarian Jihad, John Carroll was invited to speak at a gathering of area Unitarian Universalists. There, he said, Unitarian Jihad is not real, and the situation it was written to define and defy is all too real, which may be seen as a cause for despair. And then he talked about the movement that brought an end to the slave trade, which isn't to say human trafficking isn't a very real problem here and now. He recommended to us Adam Hochschild's History of the Slave Trade titled Bury the Chains, and noted that slavery was once as economically important as the oil industry is today. In 1787, a dozen Quakers, formed the first British Anti-Slavery Committee. Due to their efforts and the movement they created, 5 years later, the British House of Commons passed the first law banning slave trading. The Quakers were a tiny sect, often ridiculed because they seemed so inconsequential. They seemed so trite. And look what they did. As Carroll summed up their efforts, 5 years from 12 guys in a room to a national movement. 5 years from crackpots to visionaries. 5 years from nothing to everything. And when did Unitarian Jihad come to light? Nearly 5 years ago. Last summer, this congregation adopted the most activist mission statement of any congregation I've ever known. It is bold, and it will require courage to live into. It will also take time to discover how best to live into it. I am sure there will be fits and starts, awkward moments, and some outright failures. I know a talk I gave last year on my own history with race relations left some of you cold. The main thing is that we keep our conversations rooted in our integrity. Our mission statement, in the degree to which we choose to embody it, will require courage and persistence. When I ask myself what I'd like to see our religious tradition movement become, the answer is a little more like what we'd be if there was a true Unitarian Universalist Jihad, with jihad meaning not militant uprising, but sacred struggle. We are so good with interest group advocacy, and while these efforts are so sorely needed, but why is it so hard for us to come together in common purpose as a group as a whole? Our mission statement gives us that opportunity. There has been a lot of talk over the last 10 and 15 years specifically about how many of our youth leave our faith tradition after our classes for youth end. We've rightly developed bridging ceremonies and put a great deal of effort, though not enough, into young adult ministries. But I think we're missing something fundamental, and I use that word specifically. More than learning about religions of the world and our own UU history, we haven't sufficiently shared with our youth the embodied courage of their tribe. The courage is out there. We're just not communicating it. We forget that courage is compelling. And youth, heck, most of us, want to be involved in something courageous that's larger than ourselves. Part of creating stories worth telling to those who will come after. On my first day with you, Mark took me on his famous tour of Columbus. Being Mark, that included quite a while at the poetry section of a local bookstore. He had some things he was looking for, and he also wanted to know about the poets that I read. And there were some poets he wanted to make sure I know about, but only one poem, one section of a poem he wanted to make sure that I knew. These were those lines from Galway Kinnell's poem, Flying Home. Love is very much like courage. Perhaps it is courage, and even perhaps only courage. One of the things I've just begun doing here at the church is to introduce our youth to our seniors. I want our youth to know the wisdom and courage of their tribe. And I want our elders to both get to know our fabulous youth and also to be able to pass on the best of what they have learned, to share some of their challenges, some of the ways they have moved with courage in their lives. Let me repeat. What I want for us is to recognize and lift up the ways in which courage is so very much a part of this faith community. And together, I want us to grow our capacity for living courageously. Unlike the grandfather in Marilynne Robinson's book, we have at least one place in our lives in which to spend our courage. Here, together. Making our mission of true hospitality manifest. For being truly good neighbors isn't a nice catchphrase. It will mean, as our mission states, taking stock of our unexamined courage, privilege, and doing what we can to forge more justice in a society so sorely lacking it. If we take this on, we will have bold stories to tell the youth who are not now just beginning to scamper down our hallways. To that end, and because this comes during our annual pledge drive, I also want you to know that yesterday I upped my financial pledge for next year. Earlier this month, I submitted a pledge of 5% of my current salary. Yesterday, I increased that pledge to 7%. I will notice that change. While I know some colleagues of mine who tithe, who give 10% to the congregations they serve, I'm not quite ready to take that leap. But I believe in the work of this religious community. When I wanted other congregations I've served to do something I knew they could do if they stretched, I said, let's call this an experiment. And most of the time, but not always, those experiments paid off. I've never pledged 7% before. And I'm considering it a personal experiment. I've never pledged that much before, I said. And because Joe takes it straight from my paycheck, you'll get it. And maybe in a year from now, I'll tell you how the experiment plays out. What is important, though, is not my contribution. It's not my relationship to you. It's not even my participation in the work of this community. What is important are your relationships with each other and to the wider community. 5 years. 5 years. What do you think we can do in 5 years? The question is open. And don't forget, you've got Brother Nailgun of reasoned discussion watching your back. Thank you. Thank you.